Here they call waltzes works, and Strauss and Lanner, who play them for dancing, are known as Kapellmeisters. Not everybody thinks like that. In fact, almost everybody laughs about it. But only waltzes get printed. At the age of 20, when Chopin wrote that letter, he was savvy enough to know that in order to make a name for himself in Vienna, he'd have to write and perform music to suit the Viennese tastes of the times. So he wrote waltzes. But during the 1830s and 40s, Frederic Chopin wrote many other kinds of music too, all of it of a high artistic caliber. In this bicentennial year of Chopin's birth, we wonder what set him apart from so many other composers of his day. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
How did the Polish-born Chopin express his nationalism at a time when his native land was being absorbed by the Russian Empire? What qualities set him apart as a romantic composer? Is there any clear connection between his personal life and his music? We are guests today of Trevor Stevenson, artistic director of the Madison Bach Musicians and a specialist in historical keyboard performance.
Well, thanks for having us here at your home.
Thank you.
And what a beautiful piano you have here.
It's just wonderful. This is about an 1850 English parlor grand that was made in London by the Collard and Collard Company. This is the kind of instrument that would have gone into a beautiful library, that type of space. It was meant for, you know, a more intimate kind of a setting. It's a double strung throughout instead of triple strung like the modern piano, so that the hammers hit only two strings, and it gives it that kind of that vocal sweetness that we'll hear in a bit. It's also almost entirely wooden in its construction. It was made by very conservative makers in England who believed, and rightly so, that the more metal you put into an instrument, the more it sounded like metal. And so the plate that is here is just paper thin. It's just quarter of an inch thick, and the whole instrument weighs about 400 pounds as opposed to its modern brother, which would be 900 some pounds. It was a wedding gift to Mrs. Morris Pollock Jr. from her affectionate father-in-law, as it says on this little plate right here. And I got it here in Madison from Tim Farley at Farley's House of Pianos, and it was all kind of in shambles. He had picked it up at a sale out east. So I spent a few years getting the right strings on it and redoing the hammers. Fortunately, there are people throughout the world, or especially in Europe, that make the parts for these 19th century instruments so that the wire is the right kind of softness that they would have used back then. And the hammers are almost directly from the sheep. that is, there's no doping in the hammers. There's no plastics or anything. And it gives you this. And it's got a very mysterious pitch generator, yeah. The instrument is. And
how perfect for romantic music.
Yes, right. It's a strange combination of being extremely clear in some ways, but also there's this veil that seems to always be in the sound. And it's hard to reconcile these two, but it definitely is there. Maybe that's Chopin's, Chopin was perhaps the most precise of all of his contemporaries. His playing was precise to the nth degree, and his compositional process was rigorous to the point of madness, really. George Sand said that he just drove himself insane rewriting the same measure over and over and over
so
again.
Do we get very specific notations from Chopin in his manuscripts and his published works?
You do. I mean, I think most telling are the autographs, right, where he's working stuff out. And we have one over there. Of course, they were on radio, so you can't see it. But you ought to see what happens when he makes a mistake or he changes a measure. He obliterates the measure that he didn't like with maybe 1,000 strokes of the pen, something like that, like an autistic fit. And the fact that he was so willing to suffer for this and to chase it down, I think it shows in the music. I mean, he was exceedingly talented to begin with, but he was also a ferocious worker. And he was one of the only romantics who believed in this kind of kind of haiku type of work, boiling it down and boiling it down and boiling it down until it was as tight as it could possibly be. You know, Franz Liszt, his contemporary, wrote, I don't know, 30, 40 pages a day and hit the print button at the end, as it were. In those days, they didn't have a print button. But so it was very different.
Well, Liszt would, of course, he would go back years later and rework in a different kind of way, almost beginning to end. But Chopin got it all the way he wanted it, not in one sitting, but we would say in one iteration.
Right. And, of course, he was the master of the short form, too. I mean, you know, his longer pieces, some of them are very beautiful and all of that, but it's not his strongest suit. He really is the master of the miniature. Yeah, it's interesting that the way they worked so differently. So he's a romantic, but living, you know, in that what we now call the romantic age, but with a kind of a different set of standards is what I would say. And of course, who he worshipped was Bach. I mean, he knew the Well-Tempered Clavier from memory. And of course, you know, he wrote Preludes without fugues, which is really art with a capital A, because, you know, because prelude to what?
Right. That's so true. Well, that's romantic too, is to have maybe a beginning without an end or something that's incomplete. That was one of the hallmarks of romanticism, is the incomplete.
Yes, right. Yeah. And you know, those romantic paintings, they always show people standing among the ruins. Not always, but it's a theme that they like, is of things that are either in decay or incomplete, or the glory that was, which is, for Chopin, was quite obvious that Bach had really, and Mozart had done it better than anybody was going to do it. And he was trying to eke out what he could do. And he said so in his letters. He said, I'm sitting here with a Well-Tempered Clavier and my measly little preludes, and I'm just kind of doing what I can.
So, and he was a child prodigy too, wasn't he? And both at performing and composing.
So he grows up in Poland, you know, near Warsaw, and plays very, very well. He's an incredible player. And this is the age also where the piano has begun to take over the music world, too. I mean, it's pianos and guitars are ruling the roost. And the middle class has adopted the piano as its kind of a symbol of its domestic cohesion and bliss. You know, and Chopin is riding this wave. He tours a little bit. He's writing concertos, which are kind of showpieces. Goes to Vienna, has some success down there. Then around the age of 19 or 20, he goes to Paris and just falls in love with Paris. And I think for his generation, Paris in the 1820s and 30s was kind of what New York was in the 1920s. Everybody was there. And he could talk to people, and he could write for people, and he could also charge an amazing amount for piano lessons, which he did and which he got, you know. So was, you know, a brilliant pianist. He wasn't just good. Liszt said that Chopin's playing was perfect in the extreme. That's, you know.
So much of Chopin, if I think of him, is much more the subtlety, the nuance, these quiet moments compared to some of his flashy contemporaries.
Right. You know, the kind of the key moment with this is, you know, he was friends with Liszt, and they went to parties together, and they would often be asked to play forehand music together. So the two of them would sit down at the piano, and Chopin always ran for the bass.
Yeah. Right, to sit make on more
the,
noise.
Said, well, he said, because I'm not going to let you drown me out, because Liszt did play big. And Chopin was famous for playing in a very small dynamic range with a myriad of nuances within this thing, which is, you know, if you look back at it now, something like the photography of the mid-19th century. There are no whites and there are no blacks in it per se, but there's infinite amount of detail in the middle ranges, which we don't have anymore. Yeah.
Liszt, you know, if he was pouring on the volume and the velocity and the virtuosity and probably the hand gestures, and he'd come in and throw his gloves down before he sat at the piano.
That's right.
It sounds as if Chopin would have had trouble drawing the kind of crowds that Liszt did in a big concert hall.
Right, playing in that style. Yeah. Brilliant as he was, right. And of course, he shied away from these large public venues, too. I mean, occasionally he would schedule one and then proceed to have a nervous breakdown before it would come on. George Sand said, you know, well, what are we going to do, fill it with only your friends? You know, I mean, and because he just didn't feel comfortable playing like that and in this kind of showman-type way. But he did play almost every night in somebody's living room, like something like that. And he loved it. He would play for hours and hours. And he would improvise. too for hours, like jazz, which they all did. So he was kind of insular. He loved teaching. We should say that, just, you know, by the way, that his other way of taking his day was to teach. And he taught probably 3 hours a day, something like that, which is a lot. I mean, that's a big chunk. And if you teach, you know how tired you are after 3 hours or 4 hours of teaching. But he enjoyed it very much.
Can you give us a sample Chopin work and talk about what makes it Chopin? Where do you find his unique voice?
Let's go to one of the chestnuts, which is called the Raindrop Prelude. It's an amazing piece. It's, I think, kind of reborn on this 19th century instrument as well. And it also has a great story with it. So this is the prelude in D flat major from his set of preludes, Opus 28. And Chopin doesn't call it Raindrop, and we'll find out in the story why.
Thank you.
So about that name, Raindrop.
Yeah, where does that come from? Right. I always think we're not in Kansas anymore. It is a Somewhere Over the Rainbow kind of piece. And yes, where does Raindrop come from? George Sand tells where the title comes from. And Chopin was very averse to giving picturesque or programmatic titles to pieces. And we'll find out again in the story why. Soon after Chopin moves to Paris at the age of 20, he hooks up with this writer named George Sand. That was her publishing name. I think it was like Aurora Dupin was her actual name. But she published under a man's name, George Sand. You know, they were just in many ways quite different. She liked to stay up all night. You got up at dawn, you know. I mean, they were different. But they got along pretty well. And I think they loved talking to each other. She was very forthright. She's a very hard worker. And at some point early in their relationship, she decides they should take a vacation together. So they're going to go to the island of Mallorca, which is a long way from Paris, you know. And Chopin is a creature of habit. He likes to do everything kind of at the same time every day if he can. So to take a vacation for somebody like this is really asking a lot. Plus, he's tubercular. I mean, he's sick. So to travel is also hard. But he sees enough advantage in it, and he wants to do this, so he says yes. So they go south, a long, long way south, and get to the Mediterranean. They get on a boat, and it's filled with pigs, and they go over, and it's just, you know, there's a biggest mess.
Not romantic.
Yeah, not romantic, right. When they get there to Mallorca, it's obvious to anybody looking at Chopin that he's sick, and he coughs all the time, and that he's got probably something like tuberculosis. And in the south of Europe, this is a stigma. You're considered to be kind of socially an outcast if you have this, because they thought it was contagious. And in the north, they didn't think it was so contagious. And it turns out the south was right. It is contagious, but nevertheless. So you had trouble staying places. If you went to a hotel or something like that, you had to buy the sheets because they don't want the sheets after you've slept on them. Because of these things, they end up staying kind of out of town. And she gets this old kind of a monastery thing that she thinks, of course, is very romantic. I mean, to be staying where the monks had stayed, you know, and all of that. Even though none of them could tolerate religion in any way. So they're staying at this kind of a castle-type place. And one evening, it's raining ferociously, and Chopin's on his own there, and George Sand and her son, by a marriage she'd had before, they're in town getting supplies or whatever. And they're late, really late. And, you know, it's pouring, cats and dogs, and they're an hour late, 2 hours late, 3 hours late, no cell phone. Right? This is pre-cell phone, right? So, you know, people just got there when they got there, right? Well, anyway, Chopin is worried and worried and worried. He's at the piano, he's playing, and, you know, remember, you have to understand, I think, that she kind of took care of him in many ways. I mean, she was his lover, but, you know, she's also was a maternal figure as well. And so he's thinking he's left. And so he has a bit of a, you know, he comes unglued. Anyway, eventually, the door opens, and out of the rain comes George Sand and her son. So sorry we're so late, you know, that roads are washed out, blah, blah, blah. And Chopin is at the piano with his hair sticking straight out. This is according to George Sand, with his hair sticking straight out, playing, which he had just written that night. And he says, first thing he says to them is, I thought you were dead, or I'm sure you were dead.
That's romantic, too.
Right, yeah, right, yeah, exactly, right. So she tries to make good and be friendly and say, you know, that's a beautiful piece you're playing. And not only is it beautiful, but it seems to me that this repeated note, that it's kind of like the rain that is still coming down on the roof, right? And Chopin, instead of taking it nicely, takes it exactly the wrong way as a challenge to their old argument about whether music represents anything or not, which he insisted that it didn't. Right, right. And he starts yelling at her. And she, I guess, backs off, whatever. Finally, when he settles down, he says, okay, maybe it, you know, maybe it represents something. I'll tell you what it represents. He says, while you were gone, you know, I came unglued and I died. A part of me died. And he was not kidding. He said, I had this dream, a waking dream. Another romantic thing, right? The waking dream. Do I wake or sleep? And in this, I was kind of, my corpse was floating on a lake. And the tears of heaven were dripping falling down upon my soul. All right. So if anything, that's what happened.
Hard to get that in a catchy title.
So there,
though.
You know. So he figures he won that round with her.
Well, she put in one of her novels the sentence, "They loved each other and lived unhappily ever after."
Oh, right. But you know, eventually they did split up, and that was worse on him. So he didn't do very well after they split up and lived unhappily ever after. But it's so wonderful. Almost 90% of the issues come to bear in this story with the romantic setting and traveling and illness and
temperament.
And what?
Temperament.
And temperament, right. Exactly, right. And
not exactly a well-tempered composer.
He was not exactly a well. And speaking of which, right, if we could segue back to why is this piece in D flat, speaking of temperament, which is the way keyboard instruments are tuned. In Chopin's day, the keyboard instruments were still tuned in an 18th century system, by and large, called well temperament, in which every key was a little bit different. And keys like C were very balanced and homogeneous, and harmonious, really. So that's C. It's wah, 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 wah. But the further you got away from C, that is, the more accidentals you got, the faster was this vibrato or these beats. So there's C and E. Now listen to D flat, which is five flats. It's almost double the beat speed of C, like that. So Chopin starts the Raindrop Prelude in D flat because the Romantics had already figured out that if you want a melody to float, you go to the high vibrato keys. You don't go to the low vibrato keys. And Chopin deliberately stays away from C major most of the time in his career. So he goes to D flat. And if you just listen to the sound, it's not very musical on its own, but the way he feathers it, it creates this beautiful diffusion and longing in the sound and over the rainbow quality. If you put it in C, listen to this. It's country western. Mm-hmm. It means it boom, 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 boom. And then C is more in tune than D flat. It's just a little flat footed. Now here it is in D flat. Isn't that, I know. So Chopin spent his entire life writing at the piano. I mean, he wrote everything at the piano because he was an aesthete and he believed in these colors that he could get out of here and the way that they could all be mixed together. And it's very, his music sounds not very good for anything but the piano. Yeah.
Let's find out what Chopin did with dances when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
Simply Folk, tonight at 5 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and with us is Trevor Stevenson. We're in his home studio where he is illustrating the music of Frédéric Chopin on an 1850 vintage piano. And Chopin, we started the hour with a reference by Chopin about dances, waltzes in particular.
Right.
But he was not exactly bending his artistry to the public will when he wrote dance music.
He wrote a lot of these Polish dances, right? And polonaises and mazurkas and some waltzes, of course, but which were more current taste. But the mazurkas, which I'd like to at least do a little bit of next, were his letters, what I call his like postcards home for most of his life. They're his most personal and intimate music and recollections of the dances that he must have loved as a kid. We also know that Chopin was a great dancer and the life of the party, too. He did impressions for people that apparently had the room on fire.
That
I know.
You don't think
so maybe
of.
Hugh Grant wasn't so wrong in that, what was it, impromptu in the movie. So anyway, so Chopin did write a lot in the dance form, and of course in those days people still danced every night pretty much, which is kind of hard to believe anymore, but they did. In the mazurkas, I'll just do one from quite early. This is, I think, written before he left Poland. This is in the key of F major. We talked about keys before. F major is a very grounded, kind of earthy key. You get it's got, you know, heavy shoes on it, like that. He wrote this one, again, before he left Poland. And also about this mazurkas, we should at least say that the way Chopin played them, even though they're in 3-4, was quite confusing to his Parisian audiences later. That people had a lot of trouble counting them with him. And we'll see why. Isn't that, I know. And I think it's like a junior high dance. I always think.
I was trying to picture myself dancing that. I think I'd end up on the floor.
Oh, yeah. No, you know, I always think these are the young kids at the dance when they.
Speeding up.
Is there something, it's 15-year-old humor, and I'm not, I can't defend it. I just feel it, right?
What exactly is a mazurka?
It's, you know, again, it's characteristic Polish dance. I've hardly have seen more than a few minutes of people dancing them, so I don't know. I'm not the person to
and
ask.
And what was going on there in that B section? It almost sounded like a harpsichord going into a different register. It sounds kind of Turkish or something.
Right. The what's going on outside the dance, right? Maybe it's the, I always think it's the coldness of the night outside the dance hall or something like that. He goes from, actually, I'm sorry, he's a lot in F, but the mazurka itself is really in B flat. But in this middle section, he goes off into G flat and uses this very exotic interval, the augmented second.
Very Eastern.
Mm-hmm. And of course, G flat is a highly, you know, toxic key. This, compare it to F. Right. You can feel the buzz in G flat. So again, he's using the temperament of his time. It's an amazing piece. We know that Chopin played these so idiomatically that one time he was teaching a student in Paris how to play a mazurka, and he had kind of an open studio where other artists were invited to come through. And a composer named Meyerbeer came in and sat in the corner and listened to Chopin playing for a while. And Meyerbeer said, "You know, that's an interesting piece." He says, "What meter is that in?" And Chopin said, "Well, it's in 3. It's a mazurka." And Meyerbeer says, "You know, I write ballets all the time, and if my dancers heard you play that, they would go immediately into 2. And well, so, and of course, this is, I guess all these stories are Chopin losing his head. So so here he is yelling at Meyerbeer. So he starts yelling at Meyerbeer and demonstrating how the mazurka, even though it may sound a little bit in 2, it's in 3. And maybe it was something like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. He tended to bunch beats like that. I thought maybe it was like a samba. I mean, played by the people who really know how to play it, the notation can't begin to cover it.
You mentioned this was an early mazurka. Right. How about a late example of a Chopin mazurka?
This is one that he wrote probably shortly after arriving in Paris, but it's extremely forward-looking in its style. I think probably 2/3 of the jazz chords in the 20th century are here in about 1830 or so. This is the A minor, opus 17, number 4.
beginning and end, it's a little bit like Take Five. I mean, I almost hear Dave Brubeck or somebody.
Isn't that amazing? That
certain points.
50s and 60s jazz. Yeah. And definitely, I hear it too, the saxophone.
And then it's kind of
wailing,
tonally adrift, it seems. At
Which
times.
One?
It's sort of tonally adrift. You don't know exactly where we are. We're kind of sliding around.
Well, and it doesn't end in any particular key. Well, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a first inversion F major chord. I mean, it's just, yeah, you're nowhere.
Right, right.
And it's like those French films with the windshield wipers in the rain, too. There's definitely some of that. I mean,
it sounds very modern for given the time it was written.
Doesn't it, though? I mean, and at the end, he just lets the tritones, which is this and again, that's jazz, too, that where the tritone goes, and he puts on top of it. It's just making itself up as it goes along. So it's one that's not played very often, and I find this particularly compelling piece. In the middle, he goes into A major, where there must be a folk song. And probably a guitar beat. It seems like a guitar type of a figure, but who knows what folk song.
Yeah, maybe the danciest part of the piece, though.
In the middle, right. Yeah.
Speaking of dances, though, okay, we started with a bit of a waltz.
Right.
What could somebody like Chopin do with or to a waltz to make it his own?
Right. And that was the minute waltz, or the minute waltz that we tried before during the prologue. I thought I would do the C-sharp minor waltz this time, which I think maybe one of his most perfect pieces among a great composer's work. I think this one is particularly amazing. He seems to have his greatest emotional focus, and the relationship between sorrow and joy are completely integrated. And he's also quoting Bach a lot in this C sharp minor waltz. He's starting that. I mean, it's no particular Bach piece. It's just that you can feel Bach is in the room, right? Right. Bach also tends to work this interval of the sixth all the time, which is, I mean, it's one of his signature things. And Chopin starts right there, almost like unaccompanied violin, like that. And then in the refrain, he does the snows of yesteryear, which is. Like that. And uses that beautiful octave. So this is a particularly Polish kind of waltz too, with this the rhythm that comes in the third and fourth bar, and then I'll play the whole thing. But this one, that beautiful little hiccup step there. seems very folksy. Just a truly amazing piece. Also notice on this older piano, the way the bass and the treble seem so far apart from each other. It's a long way down to that guy, huh? And then this, the treble is brighter than the modern. So the other thing he does here in this opening measure is that, like Bach, you seem to have, it's hard to explain in just a few seconds, but he's like, between the first and the second measure, he's showing you the inside of the inside, like the way Bach always shows you the DNA of something. So you have this, and then it immediately goes inside. Right. So, he's so looking at the inner structure of things like that. And it's very bold to have it back off. The first thing it does is it takes one step forward and then goes way inside of itself like that. So anyway, this is a very late in life for Chopin in his 39 years piece. This is Opus 64, number 2, the waltz in C sharp minor. Thank you.
That takes us quite far away from Strauss Sr. and Joseph Lanner, the ones who were so popular in Chopin's day.
It's just an amazing piece of music, I think. It's one of those, it's kind of like Hamlet is for Shakespeare. It's one of those things that no matter how many times you hear it, it's always new. Again, I defend it as being perfect even among Chopin's works.
And we haven't even heard a nocturne yet, and we'll do that and have some final thoughts on Chopin when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. Chopin was a genius of universal appeal. His music conquers the most diverse audiences. When the first notes of Chopin sound through the concert hall, there is a happy sigh of recognition. It is expressive and personal, but still a pure art. Even in this abstract atomic age where emotion is not fashionable, Chopin endures. Those are the comments of Arthur Rubinstein. I'm Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Trevor Stevenson. We're at his house with a beautiful 19th century piano, celebrating the work of Frederick Chopin, 200 years after his birth in Poland. I want to ask you a personal question, Trevor, which is, when you play Chopin, like you just did for us with the waltz, what effect does it have on you?
Wow, that's it. This is for the psychiatrist's couch kind of thing, right? How does it make you feel?
And as opposed to playing Bach or something else.
Right. You know, and we were, during the break, we were, of course, talking about similarities between Chopin and Bach. I think for instance, in the waltz and in many of the pieces, you know, there is a sense of remembrance, I think. I mean, that what we do call it romantic for a good reason, because it is about the past. And at his very best, he is looking back at the things that he loved and the things that he enjoyed. And, of course, often mingled with a fair amount of regret as well. So I find that, you know, what Rubinstein was saying too about emotion, that at least that type of emotion, very apt. And I think that goes through a lot. In this program, we're not doing the more heroic element of Chopin. You know, I mean, there's more of his type A stuff, which is for another program. But I think he's at his strongest when he is reflecting and he's in the twilight. You know, there's one scene where he's improvising for his friends, and they're kind of talking to him as he's improvising, and he's saying things like, I can't find the shadow of the form yet. I'm looking for the shadow. I mean, they really lived in that world. These are beautiful memories and shadows that he explores. And this nocturne I'm going to play is perhaps the most nostalgic of all of his works, I think. This is Opus 62, number 2 in the key of E major, and he seems to be looking back, I think, all the way back to childhood at this one, with a great sense of summary and of love. Thank you.
A modern composer, looking back on a short life, tragically short life, Frédéric Chopin.
Yeah. It's a great gift and an extremely sentimental, really. I mean, in the best sense of the word.
Trevor, it's been a pleasure spending time with you and your piano once again.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much for asking.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year. Thank you.
And thanks to Tom Blaine for helping us to bring that hour of Chopin to you.